Hello, hello. On May the 9th, Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young will be here. And now, if you will, thank you for being so patient. Nice round of applause for Led Zeppelin.
Well, what do you think of that intro? That concert is currently unreleased for the moment. It is from the Met Center, Bloomington, Minnesota, from April 12th, 1970. You are listening to episode 7, by the way. My name is Mark McFall, and you are listening to All Things Led Zeppelin, the Zepp Fan Podcast. Thank you for joining me. As the intro introduced, that is an unreleased concert. We do have the taper here with us today. So before we talk to him, a few things first. I just want to say thank you, everybody. Thank you for the great feedback on the podcast. It seems like a lot of people are really enjoying listening to this podcast as much as I enjoy doing it. This is a work in progress for me. I've never done podcasts or recording or any of this stuff before, so it's very exciting for me to dive into the Zeppelin community and talk to everybody and get to know everyone. And we have a lot of great interviews coming up. So definitely subscribe to the podcast if you can. Also, if you want to listen to previous podcasts, you could go to Apple Podcast. You could go to Spotify. Just search Zepp Fan or All Things Led Zeppelin, or just search Led Zeppelin. And it'll bring it up. Listen to it. If you don't mind, give it a review, give it a rating. It's always greatly appreciated. As I mentioned, episode 7, we have a really good one. I know you don't want to talk about anything else. You just want to hear more about this tape. So let's begin. Joining me today will be Michael Gillespie. Michael was the chief engineer in the 70s for the Canadian rock station CKY 92.1 FM. During this time, Michael, of course, was able to witness several live bands, and one live band in particular he was able to record. And that, my friends, is Led Zeppelin live at the Met Center, April 12th, 1970. It is great to have Michael here today to share with his experience taping this very early Led Zeppelin show and, of course, sharing any other experiences that he had. Let's welcome Michael to the show. Good afternoon, Michael. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. And you, Mark?
So far, so good. So I want to first thank you for joining me today. I find it very fascinating to talk to someone like yourself. One, because you saw Led Zeppelin at such an early stage of their career, and a lot of us didn't have that opportunity. If you know, Led Zeppelin only toured up to 1977, so a lot of us were waiting to see them in 1980, which unfortunately didn't happen. So I find that very fascinating to have this conversation with you, one, because you saw them at this early stage, and of course, you taped them. So thank you so much for joining me. But before diving into the Led Zeppelin aspect of your life, I mean, can you give me a little background of who you are and where you're from?
Well, sure. I'm a Canadian, born in Saskatchewan. In 1970, I guess I was 21 years old. I had begun recording when I was only 8 years old using a Webcor wire recorder. I had built a microphone when I was about 13. I was very involved in electronics and audio both. At some stage in my high school, my friends were joining bands and they all got girlfriends, and I thought that was pretty cool. So I thought if I could play an instrument, maybe I could get a girlfriend too. But I discovered I only had four fingers, so I decided bass was my instrument.
There you go. right.
Discovered really quickly as a bass player, I made a much better manager. I got the girl in the end.
And that's what it comes down to, right? Any way you can.
That's about it. I was able to pick apart bass tracks. You know, I could figure out a John Entwistle bass track. I sure as heck couldn't play it.
Right.
So I was often instructing our bass players, you know, in what the notes were. But it managed to go okay. I ended up managing several bands. Some of them were hit makers here in Canada. One had a hit across North America. But in the process, going through my university in electronics, computer science, I fell back into my electronics and And in that very year, 1970, that we're talking about, I had joined CKY as the engineer straight out of university.
Oh, very cool. Managing bands, I mean, what's that like, and what bands have you managed?
Well, most were local Canadian bands. The one that some U.S. People might remember was Sugar and Spice. So we had a track called Cruel War in January of 69 that hit number one in Canada. I don't remember what it did in the States. Earlier than that, I had a band, Love Circle. We had Canadian top 10 hits. Most of the original recording done for my bands, I actually did.
Oh, cool.
You might know the name Randy Bachman, who's the right. guitar player for the Guess Who. He wrote the two tracks, first earliest tracks for Sugar and Spice, and I recorded them. He produced it and I recorded it. So I'd been doing a lot of band recording up to that point. Not so much live bands, but in the studios that we had of the day. And so I actually became, as I got into my career at CKY, I met and knew quite a number of record executives, and they knew my recording skills. And oddly, I became well known for my tape editing capabilities. And RCA Records approached me one day and said, "We've got this live album live at the Paramount with the Guess Who."
Wow.
And it was the only time that that band ever did those particular recordings. And the guy said, "You know, we think we've got a possible hit called Running Back to Saskatoon on that album. But it's 3.5 minutes long. Could you help us and make it into a radio length track? You know, get it down to 2 minutes."
And I did that. I love that size. That's so funny.
Yeah, so I did that. I created the single hit. They never, ever recorded it again. So if you ever hear the single version, I did that. The guy came back a few months later and said, "I got another one." He said, "Procol Harum with the Edmonton Symphony in Edmonton. And so I cut Conquistador down from album length to single length and made that a single hit. And the third one that was of note, my mind has just gone completely blank. Oh, well.
It'll come to you. No.
That happens at my age.
Right.
But so dealing with tape and you know, recording and that sort of thing was second nature to me. And although recording things wasn't any part of my career in broadcasting, you know, I was the director of engineering for the radio station. I did do the odd shift in FM and a couple in AM. On certain occasions, but I quite often dragged a tape machine with me when I went to concerts and that sort of thing.
So what other bands have you recorded?
Oh, multiple. I can't think of a single noticeable one back in those days.
So the idea is every time you went to a concert, you bring along your recorder is what it sounds like.
Well, you know, if it was anything significant, one of the biggest British bands ever suddenly appeared here, and they did they had a joystick and they swung the sound in the auditorium, you know, front around the sides to the back and back again. And we ended up bringing them back into the radio station on our underground rock evening program, and I accused them of being gimmicky. But no, that wasn't the focus. When Led Zeppelin first came out, I was quite taken with their stuff, and again through the record reps and so forth that I knew, you know, I said, "I'd like to hear that." So they made a couple phone calls and got me a ticket, and off I went.
Very good. And you brought your recorder with you. And then let's talk a little bit about the recorder. What kind of equipment did you use to record it?
Well, I took with me, it was a Philips cassette deck. Philips invented the cassette deck, and in those days it was one of the earliest. It was a fairly sizable unit. 2205 comes to my mind as a model number, but I wouldn't swear to that.
Yeah.
The biggest concern I had was recording length, and so I had taken a pocket full of fresh, brand-new cassettes. And I wasn't sure, while I had the agreement of the company and the band, effectively, to do the recording, I'd had recordings destroyed in the past by having people around me, you know, yelling and screeching and obscenities and that kind of thing. So I didn't want to attract attention to myself. And I wanted to make it as good as I possibly could. So I took a couple of brand newly designed and available Sony Electret condenser microphones.
Oh, nice.
They were actually battery operated. They had a little, almost like a hearing aid battery in the microphone itself. And when I got to the gig, I arrived in a loose jacket. It was late spring, relatively nice weather, so I wasn't overdressed or underdressed, but it allowed me to put the cassette deck on a strap around my neck under my jacket. And it was a front load, or top load, I guess. Right. You know, the broad side opened out, so if I unzipped my jacket, I could pop the door open right beneath my chin. You know, swap cassettes and, you know, carry on. The microphones, I ran up my sleeves. I had a long sleeve jacket, and I held them between my little finger and my thumb, one in each hand over my head, forming a peace signal with my other remaining fingers.
Are you serious?
And I held those above my head for the entire concert.
Oh, my gosh.
So nobody knew, you know, unless they inspected the bulge in my jacket, that I had a tape machine, and nobody could see the tiny little microphones in my fingertips.
Yeah.
And it gave me the opportunity to get the microphones above the heads of the people around me.
That's a great idea.
And you know, those are the sorts of things I learned over time, you know, doing this sort of thing. But I didn't want to be harassed by people yelling at me or, you know, and so forth. So, you know, I was trying to be incognito in that sense. Sure. And the biggest issue when you're recording that kind of thing, most people these days don't grasp what sound systems in bands were like at that time. There, you know, nowadays you have one monstrous PA system with a 100-track board out in the middle of the auditorium, you know, and all kinds of digital this, that, and the other thing. And everything the people in the audience hear is coming through the mixing desk at the front.
Yep.
It's nothing to do with the musicians. But in this particular thing with Led Zeppelin, they had actually brought in an advertised exotic sound system for this concert, but it was actually a pile of crap. They had what looked like megaphone bullhorns, the sort of thing you'd see in a World War II ship, right, on tall, what were like microphone but heavier duty stands on either side. And they only amplified the upper mid-range, and they had no frequency response to them. And so that's what Robert Plant used to get his voice out. You know, that was his amplification. The rest of the band didn't have any amplification at all except their own amplifiers, wow, each one with their individual amp. You know, nowadays everybody's got stage monitors, or they got in-ear monitors, and they got all that stuff. Well, in those days, it wasn't. It was more like four guys in a bar, you know. So my challenge was to find a location where the crowd noise wasn't so high, but I also got a good balance of the bass amp and the guitar amp and the sound system being used for the organ, which, as I recall, was probably just Leslie speakers. I don't remember any, Marshall amp or anything like that in use with the organ. And the drums had nothing at all. So, wow, you know, I had to be close enough that I could hear the drums and presumably, you know, be able to hear them separate from all the rest of the noise around me. And I think you've now heard excerpts, at least, right, of the tape, and generally, I think I did pretty good.
Yeah, you did an amazing job, and I think that's pretty outstanding that you held your hands up to record it, because that's definitely a great way to go, because I've heard so many live recordings where you hear people next to them talking and so forth, so that's a great idea. Now, are you saying the sound for the show wasn't very good?
The sound for the show was terrible.
Okay.
The public address system used for the vocals, as I said, was something you might find at, you know, somebody yelling through a megaphone at a football game. They did try to bring up the power, but it went out several times and simply stopped.
Right. So what, let me ask you real quick, what do you remember about that? Because hearing the show, it sounds like after the first song, We're Gonna Groove, they had to take like a 3-4 minute break, and Plant went on a rant about the PA system and so forth.
Oh, yeah.
What was that all about?
He did that several times. I mean, they started their first track, which I don't recall what it was.
We're Gonna Groove.
But it completely overwhelmed the public address, and the vocals went out, period.
Oh, that's...
You know, it didn't affect the instruments. You know, they were separately powered and so forth. But I think for the first few minutes of the recording, you can hear the PA squealing, right, feeding back and cutting out, and terrible, terrible distortion. You know, at some point, a disc jockey from some Minneapolis station, you know, came out to introduce them. And his voice was so distorted you couldn't understand it, but you can hear they pull it back down again. And when the band finally starts their second track, it again sounds like everything explodes. But
right.
the guy on the PA and whatever he had, he dropped the levels down to nothing, and then brought them back up slowly.
Right.
And from that point forward, it was a reasonable thing, but Robert Plant's voice was terribly distorted through the entire thing. You can hear it. You can hear his voice. You can hear the words he's singing, but it's got this terrible tearing, sound behind it of the PA simply overloading.
1, 2.
Let's get some noise. Can we just get some noise? Is he going to go up again, Mr. Man in the Box? Right, now I've got to stand with a bloody mic in my hand all night. Nice microphone. These were last perfected in 1932. And it belongs to Harry McHugh. I've got 2 inches of my lead line. We're super cool. We've got some performing monkeys coming on in a minute. In fact, they're at the side now fixing the PA. All that, we're as straight as a dime. Pretend we haven't started, okay? We're gonna start now.
So would you say that's common among 70 concerts, not just Led Zeppelin, just like not having ample PA systems and sound setups?
It wasn't uncommon in that was the standard way of doing things.
Right.
At that time, there were far, far better PA systems. The ones that I'd experienced in my own career, on my biggest band, I mentioned earlier, Sugar and Spice, our first live gig, we opened for The Who.
Oh, wow.
And, the PA system there was Sun, S-U-N-N. And it blew out in the first couple of tracks and then had to be reset up. And then they, paused and they came up and set up more equipment. I mean, that wasn't completely uncommon, but it was, the arenas and the number of people and the touring bands were all expecting something to be there and ready for them, and the local people simply had no idea what they were doing.
Mm.
I've seen a music store empty itself of amplifiers where they run all the speakers in parallel and plug them all in together. That happened to me more. There was a separate event with Led Zeppelin later the very same year, I believe, in 1970, that fall, maybe August or September, I don't remember the date, where Led Zeppelin played in our city in Winnipeg.
Right.
And it was part of a very big deal with a lot of big bands, including my band, which came on mid-afternoon. But it was in a football stadium, and suddenly the sky went dark and it began to pour, and
everybody
was ankle deep in water. Well, they decided they were going to cancel this thing, but the promoters who paid big money to get it going made very quick plans, and right next to the football stadium was a hockey arena. So everybody got up and picked all the amplifiers up and dragged them to the rain. And by this point, who had a ticket and who didn't was completely lost. you know, and it was just mad rush. It was like, you know, one of the worst days at Woodstock, people, you know, in the mud right. and half naked. And, but Led Zeppelin did come on later that night. And again, it was with amplifiers provided by every band there who stacked them all up in an arena where there was no seating and no stage. They set up some low thing. So everything was bad. And it got so, you know, there was sweat running down the walls of the place. And I had my gear, the very same gear with me that day, and I didn't even bother turning it on. You know, it was just so awful. There was no possible way I could record the band on that event. But during those few years, early 70s, it was the industry trying to catch up to the music industry in large venues and large bands and tens of thousands of people showing up. This was all new.
Yeah. And just trial by fire, just trying to figure it out. And I just looked up and it looks like that show you're talking about with the Winnipeg shows, August 29th, 1970, the Man Pop go. Festival in Winnipeg
That's
Arena.
Right. Yeah. And that was a big deal. You know, I've again forgotten, but we had some very big bands there, including Led Zeppelin. Yeah, it was trial by fire trying to make those things work. Right. And
let me ask you, other than the audio issue, I mean, what do you recall from the show? Like visually, were they impressive to you? I mean, just Jimmy during White Summer, was that exciting? What do you recall from that?
I was very focused.
keeping the peace signs up.
Yeah, and you know the crowd was sometimes pretty quiet. You'll hear between the odd track, there's a smatter of applause, and other times you hear whistles and cheers. I think everybody was a little uncomfortable just with all of the circumstances. Despite Plant, you know, raging at the PA system occasionally, I thought everybody else did really well. You know, I thought Jimmy Page played exquisitely.
Right. And listening to the tape, it sounds like during White Summer and Black Mountainside, that was one of the loudest times the audience was with after Jimmy's solo. So that was pretty cool. Another thing I recall too, listening to it, is the beginning of What Is and What Should Never Be. They came out and had a miscue, and Paige came up to the mic and apologized, like, sorry for what happened. And then, of course, Plant says something like, "We really are having a great time here. We want you to realize that." Mentions John Wayne not having these kind of troubles, so really interesting stuff.
Yes. I think they braved through it. They weren't nearly so accommodating later that summer when they played in Winnipeg. With the rain, Peter Grant just said, we're out of here.
Right. And one of the things I noticed about this show, too, is at some of the shows, it's hard to say, but they usually do how many more times in between John Bonham's Moby Dick and then Whole Lot of Love. And at this show, they didn't do how many more times. And usually how many more times is a 20, 30 minute song where they do a lot of medleys and stuff. And that could be one of the reasons why they decided to cut it, is because of what they're experiencing at the show.
Well, they'd been there for hours. Right. I mean, the Winnipeg was far, far worse. I mean, they were supposed to play late afternoon. They didn't play till after midnight.
Yeah.
In Bloomfield, they had had a football event or an ice skating event or something just prior, and it was like 3 hours late starting just because they couldn't get the stage set up. And, you know, and so everything was going long, and I thought generally they were in pretty good spirits.
Right.
I thought they played well.
Yeah. When I mentioned the early shows, that's the thing with Led Zeppelin. In this time during 69 and 70, they were just unstoppable regardless of what type of weather or monitors they're experiencing. When they played hard. So it's really exciting to hear this, especially being a brand new tape. Are these tapes still in existence, the cassettes?
Well, for the longest time, they weren't. This all happened, as I say, in 1970. As it happened, our station and another station I had worked with across the street, an AM station, got permission from Warner, and we broadcast both the concert on both stations, on AM and on FM.
Wow. So I just really quick, just to confirm, you're saying you broadcasted this show on the FM station?
Yes. And on the AM station across the street, the AM
rock
station.
Incredible. And you had permission?
We did.
Wow.
It was the same guys, the Warner Record people that I knew prior to going down. And we thought, well, this would be too cool. And they said, right. Well, let's figure it out. And what they asked us to do is they said, a lot of this stuff is unrecorded material.
Right.
And the band and the record company back wherever they were headquartered, that they were very anxious that the tapes not get into the loop, into the wild loose. And so they told us if we could, what would be the right word? If we could, cause the material to not be commercially usable during our broadcast, that we were free to broadcast it.
Interesting.
And so what you'll hear, one of the announcers, and I don't remember the exact words, but it's, "You're listening to Led Zeppelin on CKY." And they would fade that up under Led Zeppelin playing and then back out again. And so occasionally you'll almost hear that. You'll say, "What was that?"
Right. You know? And that was their way of just making the, making it not commercially usable, or making it commercially unusable in their terms.
Right. Right. It was like putting a fingerprint, you know, or a watermark on it.
Oh, interesting. So, go ahead.
And I was just going to say, it was done so at such a low level, you really don't notice it.
Yeah.
We met the condition of the record company, and yet it doesn't make it unlistenable. As they say, each time you hear it, you say, "Oh, did I hear it again?"
Right. I was going to say, that's really interesting, because nowadays I would have to go through so much red tape to get authorization to play something on the radio. And it sounds to me like you asked the rep said, "Sure, just make it commercially unusable." Is that how that went down?
Yeah, more or less. They did talk. They did talk to head office. You know, they didn't, you know, put their own out on the table waiting to get chopped off.
Yeah.
But it worked. I mean, it doesn't take away. I mean, it's no worse than some of the crowd noise in the background.
Right. Are you saying that the cassettes no longer exist, but this DJ version does, or I guess the radio version does?
Well, the way it was done on the air, cassettes aren't the most high fidelity thing in the first place. So when it was broadcast, it was literally three cassettes in the end that were broadcast directly on the air. And what happened at the time is we took a master copy of the off air. I think we originally wanted to do that, to send it to Led Zeppelin's music people, you know, to see what it was we had done and that we'd kept our word, you know, and put the fingerprint on it and that sort of thing. But so that was the tape that I had. And in the end, I kept that tape. 2 years after that, my wife and I bought and built a house, And from that date forward, I didn't know where the tapes were.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only this last spring, we're doing a major renovation on the house, and we're having to move a lot of stuff out of the way to get the tradespeople in and so forth. And at one point, my wife comes down and to the lunch counter, and she says, you know, after your lunch, go upstairs and move those boxes of tapes out of my way. And I said, what tapes? Well, it turned out there was a cupboard in the back of one of our closets where I'd stored a whole bunch of tapes, and in 50 years forgotten
right.
that the cupboard existed.
Yeah.
So I pulled them all out, and I had about 100 tapes, and lo and behold, there it is, Led Zeppelin. And blew my mind.
Right.
I was convinced that I'd never see it again.
Right.
And so I pulled it off, and I've done a lot of restoration of tapes over the years, lost tapes. I restored the 12-hour Story of the Beatles, which was
very cool.
Played in 1970 at about 500 radio stations across North America. Nobody kept a copy.
Right.
And so for 45 years, people have been saying, does anybody have a copy of that? Well, I finally found one in the basement of a radio station in Wisconsin.
Wow.
And it was so badly, what's the word I'm looking for? Saved. It wasn't saved at all. It was just raw tapes in a cardboard box under a basement desk.
Right.
And Wendy Carlos actually helped me what they call bake the tape. You know, the
right.
oxide on the tape comes off the cellophane on the back, and it destroys them if you try and play them. And so I've been through that. But when I pulled this Zeppelin tape out, it played like it was new.
Oh, that's great. And I just want to confirm with you and our listeners too, when you mention tape, you're referring to like a reel-to-reel, not a cassette tape, right?
That's right. It was a reel-to-reel tape, and it's in pretty tidy shape. I no longer have it in my possession. A crazy fan took it off my hands some years
ago. They're all crazy fans. we're all crazy one way or the other.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, when we hear about like having a having a rare Led Zeppelin show or just any master, what we go for. But yeah.
Yeah. I honestly didn't expect that.
Right.
You know, and I guess just in casual conversation, I mentioned it to somebody and who mentioned it to somebody, and in the end, I'm talking to you.
Right, exactly. And that's how it goes, right?
Yeah.
I also wanted to ask you a question about regarding a handbill, because there was a handbill for this show, like a tan 4-inch by, I think, 6-inch flyer. Do you remember seeing that one at all?
I think maybe I've seen a copy online somewhere when I was searching out for other information regarding this particular event. But no, If I ever had one, I certainly don't know.
Right. And I was going to say, what's interesting about handbills, as you probably know with old artists, these handbills are now $400 or $500. So it's pretty amazing that something that was given away at a counter probably is now worth so
sure.
much.
So. Yeah. But you're crediting my brain with talent it doesn't have. That was 53 years ago.
Right. Well, like I said, you know, when you get like a collector that, you know, knows the ins and outs, and they meet somebody, they just ask all sorts of questions. And I know for me, I would never remember any, you know, what shows that I've gone to, what year, you know, what songs they performed. It's like, I remember being there. I saw Aerosmith, you know, Rolling Stones and all these bands. But I don't remember what they played. It just, you know, the lives we live and just enjoying the concerts. But Michael, I just want to say thanks again for everything, for joining me and kind of sharing your story. Is there anything you want to share with us, or is there anything else that you want to tell us about this tape?
Well, I hope if anybody gets to hear it, they'll enjoy it. I was anxious when I got the tape, you know, 53 years hindsight, you know, what did it really sound like? And I think it came off pretty good and represents the band pretty well. It certainly is what I remember of them. It's just sort of been an exciting ride just to get involved and, you know, get that tape, you know, cleaned up a little bit and out into the world, and we'll see what happens
in
the future.
And we definitely thank you for it. But before I let you go, I actually have the set list here. So I wanted to kind of read it so everybody knows what they played.
So,
as you mentioned, it starts off with the announcer, and he introduces Led Zeppelin. they go into We're Gonna Groove. At the end of We're Gonna Groove, that's where Plant kind of goes into about a 3-4 minute riff about the PA system, and they had to take a break. They went into Dazed and Confused, Heartbreaker, Bring It On Home, White Summer, and Black Mountainside. Since I've Been Loving You, at the very end of Since I've Been Loving You, the end does cut. The organ solo, Thank You. And as I talked about a little bit earlier, they did What Is and What Should Never Be. And they did the first couple seconds and then they stopped. Paige apologizes. And then Plant went on another rant about the PA system. Then they finished the song. They did Moby Dick, Whole Lot of Love. And then they did Communication Breakdown, which is also cool because they didn't do Communication Breakdown that often around this time. And then it ends with the radio DJ talking about the show and thanking you for lending them the tape. And they actually made reference to the, what is it? How do I do it? I'm not a DJ. The CKY 92.1 FM.
Right.
So pretty right. Interesting stuff. And thank you so much for making this come to life and just, you know, saving it after so many years. Because I've met people that tape stuff or filmed them and they ended up just throwing it away. So it's great that you still have your archive collection of everything.
Yeah, well, you're welcome. I enjoyed the conversation and I hope anybody who hears it manages to enjoy it.
All right, Michael. Well, super. It's been great talking to you. You enjoy the rest of your day, okay?
You betcha.
Okay,
thank you.
Thanks. Bye.
Led Zeppelin in concert in Minneapolis. We'd like to thank Mike Gillespie, our station engineer, for going down to Minneapolis and taping the Zeppelin concert under, I might mention, not the best of conditions, but he did a good job anyway. And we'd also like to thank Atco Warner Brothers Records.
Well, that is it. Another show in the books. That was episode 7. I do want to say that Michael did call me right after the podcast and wanted to let me know that he was talking about the band Sugarloaf and one of the songs, and he couldn't remember the songs, which was the most famous song by this group, and he was referring to Green Eyed Lady. So that's a very popular song, and I'm sure a lot of you have heard that. So I just want to let you know that that was the song he was referring to. As far as this concert, as far as I know, it's still not circulated at the time of release of this podcast, but as you know, in the Zeppelin world, all that stuff can change. Other than that, hey, enjoy your day, enjoy your evening, grab a beverage, listen to some Zeppelin, and enjoy. Happy holidays. Bye-bye.